Incidentally, both of my varsity basketball coaches were former Celtic players. One, Elmer Ripley, is now in the Hall of Fame, and the other was Ken Leffler.
There you are, back in Philadelphia, attending both PCP and Temple. Were you also working at the company?
I was auditing the legislative program with my father, and attended meetings, and even went to one drug manufacturers meeting because of the intense discussion of the ramifications of both a new Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, as it was then called, and a Federal Trade Commission Act.
So that act was passed really in 1938, but there was considerable build-up to it, I gather, of attempts at legislation.
Well, Congress and the agencies of the federal government were quite concerned about the poisoning and ill effects of many of the drugs on the market, and considered the Food and Drug Act of 1906 inadequate to protect the customer, and that false claims and advertising had to be banned. Another group over in the House and the Senate believed that the Federal Trade Commission had the power to act on false advertising, and therefore they wanted stricter law passed, and also a requirement that they, rather than the Food and Drug Administration, be the agency which patrolled the advertising of all drug products. Consequently, there was some rivalry between the two groups, but it led to the passage of the Wheeler-Lee Act in March 1938, which gave the Federal Trade Commission the power to act on false advertising. Later, in that same year, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938 was passed, giving the Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration, which was the agency formed under it, the power to determine the, quote, safety for use, unquote, of all drugs and devices for human use. Also note that inasmuch as it was replacing the Food and Drug Act of 1906, it also covered cosmetics, but it did not cover natural drugs as we have seen them introduced on the market today.
Do you mean that the derivatives, the hormone derivatives that they began to introduce about that time weren't covered, you know, like thyroxine?
If they were called thyroxine, they were covered. If it was cava-cava, which is on the market today, and used as such, it wasn't covered. And the Food and Drug wanted it covered, but there was a there was a lobbying group that persuaded the senators not to put it in. And I think it's unfortunate, but now let me just add one thing, because I think this is what was a factor in the decision. That would be desirable to include. And I thought I had the number of deaths that I just wanted to be accurate, but I have that, I know, somewhere. Yes, I found it, my notes on the side. Let's say I should add that an unfortunate use of the wrong solvent in an oral product led to the death of 73 individuals who had taken an elixir of sulfanilamide made by Massengill Company. And while Senator Wheeler and Representative Lee were adamant about giving the power to act on false advertising, there was a united opinion that there must be a provision to prevent a tragedy of this sort. And therefore, in June of 1938, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938 was passed. And it required, among other provisions, that a new drug be submitted to the Food and Drug Administration and be approved prior to its introduction on the market.
Ask you next. You said that you actually went to a meeting of the National
American Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association meeting, where there was discussion about the desirability of a new act and the provisions that had been proposed.
So you were 23 at the time, something like that, 24? Early 20s.
Early 20s.
And what was their attitude toward this coming act?
This was 1935. Well, I'm going to be very careful here and not critical of anyone or the industry, but it was apparent that the pharmacology was coming of age, and that that therapeutics and pharmaceutical products must be based on pharmacology. And this, of course, would include toxicology and the necessary studies to ensure safety for use.
So were the old guard not happy about this new wave that was coming along? Or was it some were and some weren't?
Well, naturally, I, with my training, understood the position of those that realized that pharmacology and its application to the development of new drugs should be used as the determinant whether or not ones who put a new product on the market. However, many of them were concerned with the regulation of the industry and the companies by bureaucrats who were perhaps motivated by bureaucrats without technical background who would be motivated by other reasons. And therefore, there was great discussion and concern.
So what happened back at McNeil Laboratories?
Well, the reason I was asked to attend was, of course, to participate in various sessions where I would be exposed to viewpoints and influence decisions which the firm would have to make. I consequently, on the outside, did more listening and less speaking and expressing views, but when we returned, I had to be frank and indicate that we had no alternative than to on passage, no, if that was my fault for not where did we cut off,
you know? You were saying that that you had to indicate to the people at McNeil that if the law were passed, there was no doubt about it that they were going to have to make changes in order to implement or to abide by this law.
It was on what I had. It didn't say much at meetings,
right,
in groups.
Right.
I didn't. Then when I go back, that's when it makes sure you know.
Right.
Well, then, okay. When I returned and in private session, I, of course, had to indicate to my father that this would mean a revision of most of the products, elimination of some, and compliance with the safety for use provision. And I, of course, gave him examples, and I believe he, as a graduate of Wharton School and not of science, appreciated the critical period that lay ahead if the law were enacted. You start with your question and I'll go right through it because I'm no problem.
Okay. Perhaps you could explain to us the kind of pharmaceutical business that McNeil was in up to that point.
Well, at that time, McNeil Laboratories sold principally to the dispensing physician. In the past, they had featured surgical dressings, instruments, along with pharmaceutical products and sundries. This was under the name of Robert McNeil, and they had a full line, copy of which I will put in the archives, in 1921. However, as time went on, they sold more pharmaceuticals and products that were required by the dispensing physician. For instance, gauze, spatulas, tape, first aid cabinets, bottles, so that a dispensing physician could buy in bulk and then give to his patient as he made the rounds 3 or 4 ounces of a cough syrup. The war came along and, of course, eliminated dispensing physician. But McNeil Laboratory had an excellent control lab, was one of the leaders in control, and hence had products that met the label statement and accurately delivered what was on the label.
Now, you were saying that the war eliminated the dispensing physicians. That's World War II.
I'll put World War II in.
Yeah.
When I edit, I'll put that in. So therefore, now let's start in. The company and I were faced with complete examination of every product in the line and determine whether or not it is safe, whether or not it was safe for use under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which was passed in June 1938 and became effective 1 year later, June 1939. Consequently, after I graduated from the College of Pharmacy, I immediately went to work and studied every product in the line to determine whether or not it should be continued, and if so, how we relabeled it so that it complied with the provisions of the Act. Fortunately, our control division was so expert that the head of control worked with me and checked on all dosages, our method for determining accuracy, our assay methods, and so that once we made a change, we were comfortable in presenting the product in 1959 that in full compliance with the law.
So how many products did you have to winnow about?
Well, the sales group counted them at one point, and in that year, Harry Shull, the head of our control division, and I went through 1,400 products and changed the label on all of those that remained in the list.
And just about how many did you wind up with?
I can't tell you. We were so busy doing things we didn't bother to count. We would change the label and have printer change the label, and remember, stock had to be changed, so we had to coordinate the manufacture of new batches with the new label. Mm-hmm. And consequently, we had our hands full, but we did have cooperation of those in manufacturing and elsewhere. Of course, he didn't like it. Of course,
the transcriber's going to love this pile driving.
Of course, the sales group were much disturbed because we eliminated many old products which they had been selling to physicians, and they felt that if a physician wanted a product and ordered it, he should have it. We were not the one telling him to prescribe. He was the one deciding what he wanted to give his patient. So that in that respect, I wasn't the most popular person in the plant, with the salesman.
Tell me how you...
And I might add, they were paid on commission in those days.
Tell me how you did determine whether something was toxic or safe for use, I guess is the better way to put it.
Well, on many products, it was fairly easy to eliminate them, because if they had corrosive sublimate or mercury in them, which they had, they went out. There's a good example. Mm-hmm. If the product had other ingredients that were useful, then we formulated a new product which had those ingredients but didn't have the undesirable element. Does that answer?
Right.
Now, for instance, there was a Bloods product, Bloods arsenic corrosive sublimate and strychnine, which had two drugs that couldn't be used, and consequently that product was dropped entirely. And I, with my pharmacology background and a few pharmacology references and textbooks, one of which I had used in my year at Temple, written by a John Hopkins pharmacologist, along with some Goodman and Gilman articles, made it very easy for me to find support for the products I eliminated.
So you basically had to do a literature search to find that it's not that you had to set up your own laboratories and feed them.
Yes, fortunately we had a very good journal in those days, the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics. And the articles there were, what's the word for judge?
Were refereed
to the point where if we knew the author and the group, why we could count on there being the consensus of opinion. Remember, the Food and Drug Administration didn't know as much as we did, and therefore they had to use the same guidelines. And it was for that reason that they then adopted the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics and Goodman and Gilman when it was published.
As the standard,
which...
Fascinating. So that's the old medicines. Then you were busy developing new medicines that the company might sell. Can you talk about any of the products, the new products?
Then it was apparent, yes, that we would change the thrust of the business and sell not only the dispensing physician, but also the prescribing physician. And with that in mind, the first specialty product was Elixir Hepatinic, which was a combination of iron in a ferrous form that would be absorbed, whereas ferric is not absorbed, along with vitamins in a strength that would correct a deficiency, and a liver extract that would provide the other B factors and other nutritious elements which had not then been isolated and identified. And it became the best product on the market. I might add that it was in elixir form, which meant that it was easy for all ages to take.
For you, my experience. Yeah.